life. A second cousin of my father's, I think. His father was my...
He's a Fraser, you mean? I interrupted hastily. I thought he was one of the Mackenzies. He was with Dougal when I met you.
Jamie nodded.
Aye. When I decided to come over from France, I sent word to him, asking him to meet me at the coast.
He smiled wryly.
I didn't again, you see, whether it was Dougal had tried to kill me earlier. And I didn't quite like the idea of meeting several Mackenzies alone, just in case. Didn't I want to end that washing about in the surf off Skye, if that's what they had in mind?
I see. So Dougal isn't the only one who believes in witnesses.
He nodded.
Very handy things, witnesses.
On the other side of the moorland was a stretch of twisted rocks, pitted and gouged by the advance and retreat of glaciers long gone. Rainwater filled the deeper pits, and thistle and tansy and meadowsweet surrounded these tarns with thick growth, the flowers reflected in the still water. Sterile and fishless, these pools dotted the landscape and formed traps for unwary travellers who might easily stumble into one in darkness and be forced to spend a wet and uncomfortable night on the moor. We sat down beside one pool to eat our morning meal of bread and cheese. This tarn at least had birds. Swallows dipped low over the water to drink, and plovers and curlews poked long bills into the muddy earth at its edges, digging for insects. I tossed crumbs of bread onto the mud for the birds. A curlew eyed one suspiciously, but while it was still making up its mind, a quick swallow zoomed in under its bill and made off with the treat. The curlew ruffled its feathers and went back to its industrious digging. Jamie called my attention to a plover, calling and dragging a seemingly broken wing near us.
"She's a nest somewhere near," I said.
"Over there."
He had to point it out several times before I finally spotted it. A shallow depression, quite out in the open, but with its four spotted eggs so close in appearance to the leaf-speckled bank that when I blinked, I lost sight of the nest again. Picking up a stick, Jamie gently poked the nest, pushing one egg out of place. The mother plover, excited, ran up almost in front of him. He sat back on his heels, quite motionless, letting the bird dart back and forth, squalling. There was a flash of movement, and he held the bird in his hand, suddenly still. He spoke to the bird in Gaelic, a quiet, hissing sort of speech, as he stroked the soft, mottled plumage with one finger. The bird crouched in his hand, completely motionless, even the reflections frozen in its round black eyes. He set it gently on the ground, but the bird didn't move away until he said a few more words and waved his hand slowly back and forth behind it. It gave a short jerk and darted away into the weeds. He watched it go and, quite unconscious, crossed himself.
"Why did you do that?" I asked, curious. "What?"
He was momentarily startled. I think he had forgotten I was there. "You crossed yourself when the bird flew off. I wondered why." He shrugged, mildly embarrassed.
"Oh, well, it's an old tale, is all. Why plovers cry as they do and run keening about their nests like that."
He motioned to the far side of the tarn, where another plover was doing exactly that. He watched the bird for a few moments, abstracted.
"Plovers have the souls of young mothers dead in childbirth," he said.
He glanced aside at me shyly.
"The story goes that they cry and run about their nests because they cannot believe the young are safe hatched. They're mourning always for the lost one, or looking for a child left behind."
He squatted by the nest and nudged the oblong egg with his stick, turning it bit by bit until the pointed end faced in like the others. He stayed squatting, even after the egg had been replaced, balancing the stick across his thighs, staring out over the still waters of the tarn.
"It's only habit, I suppose," he said. "I did it first when I was much younger, when I first heard that story. I didn't really believe they have souls, of course, even then. But you can, just as a bit of respect.
He looked up at me and smiled suddenly.
I've done it so often now, I'd not even notice. There's quite a few plovers in Scotland, you can.
He rose and tossed the stick aside.
Let's go on now. There's a place I want to show you, near the top of the hill yon.
He took my elbow to help me out of the declivity, and we set off up the slope. I had heard what he said to the plover he released. Though I had only a few words of Gaelic, I had heard the old salutation often enough to be familiar with it.
God go with you, mother, he had said.
A young mother dead in childbirth, and a child left behind. I touched his arm, and he looked down at me. How old were you? I asked. He gave me a half smile.
8, he answered. Weaned, at least.
He spoke no more, but led me uphill. We were in sloping foothills now, thick with heather. Just beyond, the countryside changed abruptly, with huge heaps of granite rearing up from the earth, surrounded by clusters of sycamore and larch. We came over the crest of the hill, and left the plovers crying by the tarns behind us.
The sun was growing hot, and after an hour of shoving through thick foliage, even with Jamie doing most of the shoving, I was ready for a rest.
We found a shady spot at the foot of one of the granite outcrops. The spot reminded me a bit of the place where I had first met Murta and parted company with Captain Randall. Still, it was pleasant here. Jamie told me that we were alone because of the constant birdsong all around. If anyone came near, most birds would stop singing, though the jays and the jackdaws would screech and call in alarm.
Always hide in the forests, Asnach, he advised me. If you dinna move too much yourself, the birds will tell you in plenty of time if anyone's near.
Looking back from pointing out a squawking jay in the tree overhead, his eyes caught mine, and we sat as though frozen within hand's reach, but not touching, barely breathing. After time, the jay grew bored with us and left. It was Jamie who looked away first, with an almost imperceptible shiver, as though he were cold. The heads of shaggy-capped mushrooms poked whitely through the mould beneath the ferns. Jamie's blunt forefinger flipped one off its stem and traced the spokes of the basidium as he marshalled his next words. When he spoke carefully, as now, he all but lost the slight Scots accent that usually marked his speech.
I do not wish to. That is, I do not mean to imply.
He looked up suddenly and smiled with a helpless gesture.
I dinna want to insult you by sounding as though I think you've a vast experience of men, is all. But it would be foolish to pretend that you don't know more than I do about such matters. What I meant to ask is this usual? What it is between us when I touch you, when you lie with me? Is it always so between a man and a woman?
In spite of his difficulties, I knew exactly what he meant. His gaze was direct, holding my eyes as he waited my answer. I wanted to look away, but couldn't. There's often something like it, I said, and had to stop and clear my throat. But no, it isn't usual. I have no idea why, but no, this is different. He relaxed a bit, as though I had confirmed something about which he'd been anxious.
I thought perhaps not. I've not lain with a woman before, but I've, had my hands on a few.
He smiled shyly and shook his head.
It wasna the same, I mean. I've held women in my arms before and kissed them and... Well,
he waved a hand, dismissing the and.
It was very pleasant indeed. Made my heart pound and my breath come short and all that. But it wasn't at all as it is when I take you in my arms and kiss you.
His eyes, I thought, were the colour of lakes and skies, and as fathomless as either. He reached out and touched my lower lip, barely brushing the edge.
It starts out the same, but then, after a moment, he said, speaking softly, suddenly it's as though I've a living flame in my arms.
His touch grew firm, outlining my lips and caressing the line of my jaw.
And I want only to throw myself into it and be consumed.
I thought of telling him that his own touch seared my skin and filled my veins with fire. But I was already alight and glowing like a brand. I closed my eyes and felt the kindling touch move to cheek and temple, ear and neck, and shuddered as his hands dropped to my waist and drew me close.
Jamie seemed to have a definite idea where we were going. At length he stopped at the foot of a huge rock, some 20 feet high, warty with lumps and jagged cracks. Tansy and Eglantine had taken root in the cracks and waved in precarious yellow flags against the stone. He took my hand and nodded at the rock face before us.
"Do you see the steps there, Sasnach? Think you can manage it?"
There were, in fact, faintly marked protuberances in the stone, rising at an angle across the face of the rock. Some were bona fide ledges, and others merely a foothold for lichens. I couldn't tell whether they were natural, or perhaps had known some assistance in their forming. But I thought it might just be possible to climb them, even in a full-length skirt and tight bodice. With some slippages and scares, and with Jamie pushing helpfully from the rear on occasion, I made it to the top of the rock and paused to look around. The view was spectacular. The dark bulk of a mountain rose to the east, while far below to the south the foothills ran out into a vast barren moorland. The top of the rock sloped inward from all sides, forming a shallow dish. In the centre of the dish was a blackened circle with the sooty remnants of charred sticks. We were not the first visitors then.
You knew this place?
Jamie stood to one side a little, observing me and taking pleasure in my raptness. He shrugged, deprecating.
Oh, aye. I know most places through this part of the Highlands. Come here. There's a spot you can sit and see down to where the road comes past the hill.
The inn also was visible from here, reduced from dollhouse to child's building block by the distance. A few tethered horses were clustered under the trees by the road, small blobs of brown and black from here. No trees grew on the top of the rock, and the sun was hot on my back. We sat side by side, legs dangling over the edge, and companionably shared one of the bottles of ale that Jamie had thoughtfully lifted from the well in the inn yard as we left. There were no trees atop the rock, but the smaller plants, the ones that could gain a foothold in the precarious cracks and root themselves in meagre soil, sprouted here and there, raising their faces bravely to the hot spring sun. There was a small clump of daisies sheltering the lee of an outcrop near my hand, and I reached to pluck one. There was a faint whirr, and the daisy leapt off its stem and landed on my knee. I stared stupidly, my mind unable to make sense of this bizarre behaviour. Jamie, a good deal faster than I in his apprehensions, had flung himself flat on the rock. "Get down," he said. A large hand fastened on my elbow and jerked me flat beside him. As I hit the spongy moss, I saw the shaft of the arrow still quivering above my face, where it had struck home in a cleft of the outcrop. I froze, afraid even to look around, and tried to press myself still flatter against the ground. Jamie was motionless at my side, so still that he might have been a stone himself. Even the birds and insects seemed to have paused in their song, and the air hung breathless and waiting. Suddenly, Jamie began to laugh. He sat up and, grasping the arrow by the shaft, twisted it carefully out of the rock. It was fletched with the split tail feathers of a woodpecker, I saw, and banded with blue thread, wrapped in a line half an inch wide below the quills. Laying the arrow aside, Jamie cupped his hands around his mouth and gave a remarkably good imitation of the call of a green woodpecker. He lowered his hands and waited. In a moment, the call was answered from the grove below, and a broad smile spread across his face. "A friend of yours?" I guessed. He nodded, eyes intent on the narrow path up the rock face.
"Hugh Monroe, unless someone else has taken to making arrows in his style."
We waited a moment longer, but no one appeared on the path below.
"Ah," said Jamie softly,
and whirled around just in time to confront a head rising slowly above the edge of the rock behind us. The head burst into a jack-o'-lantern grin, snaggle-toothed and jolly, beaming with pleasure at surprising us. The head itself was roughly pumpkin-shaped, the impression enhanced by the orange-brown leathery skin that covered not only the face, but the round, bald crown of the head as well. Few pumpkins, however, could boast such a luxuriant growth of beard, nor such a pair of bright blue eyes. Stubby hands with filthy nails planted themselves beneath the beard and swiftly hoisted the remainder of the jack-o'-lantern up into view. The body rather matched the head, having a distinct look of the Halloween goblin about it. The shoulders were very broad, but hunched and slanted, one being considerably higher than the other. One leg, too, seemed somewhat shorter than its fellow, giving the man a rather hopping, hitching sort of gait. Monroe, if this was indeed Jamie's friend, was clad in what appeared to be multiple layers of rags, the faded colours of berry-dyed fabric peeking out through rents in a shapeless garment that might once have been a woman's smock. He carried no sporran at his belt, which was, in any case, no more than a frayed length of rope, from which two furry carcasses swung head down. Instead, he had a fat leather wallet slung across his chest of surprisingly good quality, considering the rest of his outfit. A collection of small metal oddments dangled from the strap of the wallet. Religious medals, military decorations, what looked to be old uniform buttons, worn coins, pierced and sewn on, and three or four small rectangular bits of metal, dull grey and with cryptic marks incised in their surfaces. Jamie rose as the creature hopped nimbly over the intervening protrusions of rock, and the two men embraced warmly, thumping each other hard on the back in the odd fashion of manly greeting.
"And how goes it, then, with the House of Monroe?" inquired Jamie, standing back at length and surveying his old companion.
Monroe ducked his head and made an odd gobbling noise, grinning. Then, raising his eyebrows, he nodded in my direction and waved his stubby hands in a strangely graceful interrogatory gesture.
"My wife," said Jamie, reddening slightly with a mixture of shyness and pride at the new introduction. "Married but the 2 days."
Monroe smiled more broadly still at this information and executed a remarkably complex and graceful bow, involving the rapid touching of head, heart and lips, and ending up in a near horizontal position on the ground at my feet. Having executed this striking manoeuvre, he sprang to his feet with the grace of an acrobat and thumped Jamie again, this time in apparent congratulation. Monroe then began an extraordinary ballet of the hands, motioning to himself, away down toward the forest, at me, and back to himself, with such an array of gestures and wavings that I could hardly follow his flying hands. I had seen deaf-mute talk before, but never executed so swiftly and gracefully.
"Is that so, then?" Jamie exclaimed. It was his turn to buffet the other man in congratulation. No wonder men got impervious to superficial pain, I thought. It came from this habit of hammering each other incessantly. "He's married as well," Jamie explained, turning to me. "6 months married since. To a widow." "Oh, all right, to a fat widow," he amended, in response to an emphatic gesture from Monroe. with 6 children down in the village of Dublern.
How nice, I said politely.
It looks as though they'll eat well, at least.
I motioned to the rabbits hanging from his belt.
Monroe at once unfastened one of the corpses and handed it to me with such an expression of beaming goodwill that I felt obliged to accept it, smiling back and hoping privately that it didn't harbour fleas.
A wedding gift, said Jamie, and most welcome, Monroe. You must allow us to return the favour.
With which he extracted one of the bottles of ale from its mossy bed and handed it across.
The courtesies attended to in this manner, we all sat down again to a companionable sharing of the third bottle. Jamie and Monroe carried on an exchange of news, gossip, and conversation, which seemed no less free for the fact that only one of them spoke. I took little part in the conversation, being unable to read Monroe's hand signs, though Jamie did his best to include me by translation and reference. At one point, Jamie jabbed a thumb at the rectangular bits of lead that adorned Monroe's strap.
"Gone official, have you?" he asked. "Or is that just for when the game is scarce?"
Monroe bobbed his head and nodded like a jack-in-the-box.
"What are they?" I asked curiously.
"Gaberlunzies."
"Oh, to be sure," I said. "Pardon my asking."
"A gaberlunzie is a license to beg, Sassenach," Jamie explained. "It's good within the borders of the parish, and only on the one day a week when begging's allowed. Each parish has its own, so the beggars from one parish cannot take over much advantage of the charity of the next."
"A system with a certain amount of elasticity, I see," I said, eyeing Monroe's stock of 4 lead seals.
"Oh, well, Monroe's a special case, you see. He was captured by the Turks at sea, spent a good many years rowing up and down in a galley, and a few more as a slave in Algiers. That's where he lost his tongue."
"They cut it out?" I felt a bit faint.
Jamie seemed undisturbed by the thought, but then he had apparently known Monroe for some time.
"Oh, aye, and broke his leg for him as well. The back too, Monroe."
"No," he amended, at a series of signs from Monroe. "The back was an accident, something that happened jumping off a wall in Alexandria.
The feet, though, that was the Turks' doing."
I didn't really want to know, but both Monroe and Jamie seemed dying to tell me.
"All right," I said, resigned. "What happened to his feet?"
With something approaching pride, Monroe stripped off his battered clogs and hose, exposing broad, splayed feet on which the skin was thickened and roughened, white shiny patches alternating with angry red areas.
"Boiling oil," said Jamie. "It's how they force captive Christians to convert to the Mussulman religion."
"It looks a very effective means of persuasion," I said. "So that's why several parishes will give him leave to beg. To make up for his trials on behalf of Christendom?"
"Aye, exactly."
Jamie was evidently pleased with my swift appreciation of the situation. Monroe also expressed his admiration with another deep salaam, followed by a very expressive, if indelicate, sequence of hand movements, which I gathered were meant to be praising my physical appearance as well.
"Thank you, man. Aye, she'll do me proud, I reckon."
Jamie, seeing my uplifted brows, tactfully turned Monroe so that his back was to me and the flying fingers hidden.
"Now, tell me, what's doing in the villages?"
The two men drew closer together, continuing their lopsided conversation with an increased intensity. Since Jamie's part seemed to be limited mainly to grunts and exclamations of interest, I could glean little of the content, and busied myself instead with a survey of the strange little rock plants sprouting from the surfaces of our perch. I had collected a pocketful of eyebright and dittany by the time they finished talking, and Hugh Monroe rose to go. With a final bow to me and a thump on the back for Jamie, he shuffled to the edge of the rock and disappeared as quickly as one of the rabbits he poached might vanish into its hole.
"What fascinating friends you have," I said.
"Oh, aye. Nice fellow, Hugh. I hunted with him and some others last year. He's on his own now that he's an official beggar, but it's what keeps him moving about the parishes. He'll know everything that goes on within the borders of Ardagh and Chest Hill.
Including the whereabouts of Horrocks, I guessed.
Jamie nodded.
Aye, and he'll carry a message for me to change the meeting place.
Which foxes Dougal rather neatly, I observed, if he had any ideas about holding you to ransom over Horrocks.
He nodded, and a smile creased one corner of his mouth.
Aye, there's that about it.
It was near supper time again as we reached the inn. This time, though, Dougal's big black and its five companions were standing in the inn yard, contentedly munching hay. Dougal himself was inside, washing the road dust from his throat with sour ale. He nodded to me and swung round to greet his nephew. Instead of speaking, though, he just stood there, head on one side, eyeing Jamie quizzically.
"Aye, that's it,"
he said finally, in the satisfied tones of a man who has solved a difficult puzzle.
"Now I know what you mind me of, lad."
He turned to me.
"Ever seen a red stag near the end of the rutting season, lass?" he said confidentially. "The poor beast in a sleep nor eat for several weeks because they canna spare the time between fighting off the other stags and serving the does. By the end of the season they're naught but skin and bones. Their eyes are deep sunk in their heads, and the only part of them that doesna shake wi' the palsy is their..."
The last of this was lost in a chorus of laughter as Jamie pulled me up the stairs. We did not come down to supper. Much later, on the edge of sleep, I felt Jamie's arm around my waist and felt his breath warm against my neck.
"Does it ever stop, the wanting you?"
His hand came around to caress my breast.
"Even when I've just left you, I want you so much my chest feels tight and my fingers ache with wanting to touch you again."
He cupped my face in the dark, thumbs stroking the arcs of my eyebrows.
"When I hold you between my two hands and feel you quiver like that, waiting for me to take you. Lord, I want to pleasure you till you cry out under me and open yourself to me. And when I take my own pleasure from you, I feel as though I've given you my soul along with my cock."
He rolled above me, and I opened my legs, wincing slightly as he entered me. He laughed softly.
"Aye, I'm a bit sore too. Do you want me to stop?"
I wrapped my legs around his hips in answer and pulled him closer.
"Would you stop?" I asked.
"No, I can't."
We laughed together, and rocked slowly, lips and fingers exploring in the dark.
"I see why the church says it's a sacrament," Jamie said dreamily.
"This?"
I said, startled.
"Why?"
"Or at least holy," he said. "I feel like God himself when I'm in you."
I laughed so hard he nearly came out. He stopped me and gripped my shoulders to steady me.
"What's so funny?"
"It's hard to imagine God doing this." Jamie resumed his movements.
"Well, if God made man in his own image, I should imagine he's got a cock."
He started to laugh as well, losing his rhythm again.
"Though you dinna remind me much of the Blessed Virgin, Sassenach."
We shook in each other's arms, laughing until we came uncoupled and rolled apart. Recovering, Jamie slapped my hip.
"Get on your knees, Sassenach."
"Why?"
"If you'll not let me be spiritual about it, you'll have to put up with my baser nature. I'm going to be a beast."
He bit my neck.
"Do you want me to be a horse, a bear, or a dog?"
"A hedgehog."
"A hedgehog? And just how does a hedgehog make love?"
he demanded. "No," I thought. "I won't. I will not." But I did. "Very carefully," I replied, giggling helplessly. "So now we know just how old that one is," I thought. Jamie collapsed in a ball, wheezing with laughter. At last he rolled over and got to his knees, groping for the flint box on the table. He glowed like red amber against the room's darkness as the wick caught and the light swelled behind him. He flopped back on the foot of the bed, grinning down at me, where I still shook on the pillow with spasms of giggles. He rubbed the back of his hand across his face and assumed a mock-stern expression.
"All right, woman. I see the time has come when I shall have to exert my authority as your husband."
"Oh, you will?"
"Aye."
He dived forward, grabbing my thighs and spreading them. I squeaked and tried to wriggle upward. "No, don't do that."
"Why not?"
He lay full length between my legs, squinting up at me. He kept a firm hold on my thighs, preventing my struggles to close them.
"Tell me, Sassenach, why don't you want me to do that?"
He rubbed his cheek against the inside of one thigh, ferocious young beard rasping the tender skin.
"Be honest. Why not?"
He rasped the other side, making me kick and squirm wildly to get away. To no avail. I turned my face into the pillow, which felt cool against my flushed cheek. "Well, if you must know," I muttered, "I don't think... Well, I'm afraid that it doesn't... I mean, the smell..." My voice faded off into an embarrassed silence. There was a sudden movement between my legs as Jamie heaved himself up. He put his arms around my hips, laid his cheek on my thigh, and laughed until the tears ran down his cheeks.
"Jesus God, Sassenach," he said at last, snorting with mirth. "Don't you know what's the first thing you do when you're getting acquainted with a new horse?"
"No," I said, completely baffled. He raised one arm, displaying a soft tuft of cinnamon-coloured hair.
"You rub your oxter over the beast's nose a few times to give him your scent and get him accustomed to you, so he won't be nervous of you."
He raised himself on his elbows, peering up over the slope of belly and breast.
"That's what you should have done with me, Sassenach. You should have rubbed my face between your legs first thing. Then I wouldn't have been skittish."
"Skittish?" He lowered his face and rubbed it deliberately back and forth, snorting and blowing in imitation of a nuzzling horse. I writhed and kicked him in the ribs with exactly as much effect as kicking a brick wall. Finally, he pressed my thighs flat again and looked up.
"Now," he said,
in a tone that brooked no opposition,
"lie still."
I felt exposed, invaded, helpless, and as though I were about to disintegrate. Jamie's breath was alternately warm and cool on my skin. "Please," I said, not knowing whether I meant "please stop" or "please go on." It didn't matter. He didn't mean to stop. Consciousness fragmented into a number of small, separate sensations. The roughness of the linen pillow, nubbled with embroidered flowers, the oily reek of the lamp, mingled with the fainter scent of roast beef and ale, and the still fainter wisps of freshness from the wilting flowers in the glass. The cool timbers of the wall against my left foot, the firm hands on my hips. The sensations swirled and coalesced behind my closed eyelids into a glowing sun that swelled and shrank and finally exploded with a soundless pop that left me in a warm and pulsing darkness. Dimly, from a long way away, I heard Jamie sit up.
"Well, that's a bit better," said a voice, gasping between words. "Takes a bit of effort to make you properly submissive, doesn't it?"
The bed creaked with a shifting of weight, and I felt my knees being nudged further apart.
"Not as dead as you look, I hope,"
said the voice, coming nearer. I arched upward with an inarticulate sound as exquisitely sensitive tissues were firmly parted in a fresh assault.
"Jesus Christ," I said.
There was a faint chuckle near my ear.
"I only said I felt like God, Sassenach,"
he murmured.
"I never said I was."
And later, As the rising sun began to dim the glow of the lamp, I roused from a drifting sleep to hear Jamie murmur once more,
"Does it ever stop, Claire, the wanting?"
My head fell back onto his shoulder.
"I don't know, Jamie. I really don't."
Chapter 18. Raiders in the Rocks. "What did Captain Randall say?" I asked. With Dougal on one side and Jamie on the other, there was barely room for the three horses to ride abreast down the narrow road. Here and there, one or both of my companions would have to drop back or spur up in order to avoid becoming entangled in the overgrowth that threatened to reclaim the crude track. Dougal glanced at me, then back at the road in order to guide his horse around a large rock. A wicked grin spread slowly across his features.
"I wasn't the best pleased about it," he said circumspectly, "though I'm not sure I should tell you what he actually said. There's likely limits even to your tolerance for bad language, Mistress Freezer."
I overlooked his sardonic use of my new title as well as the implied insult, though I saw Jamie stiffen in his saddle.
I don't suppose he means to take any steps about it?" I asked.
Despite Jamie's assurances, I had visions of scarlet-coated dragoons bursting out of the bushes, slaughtering the Scots, and dragging me away to Randall's lair for questioning. I had an uneasy feeling that Randall's ideas of interrogation might be creative, to say the least.
"Shouldn't think so," Dougal answered casually. "He's more to worry about than one stray Sassenach wench, no matter how pretty."
He raised an eyebrow and half bowed toward me, as though the compliment were meant in apology.
"He's also better sense than to rile Colum by kidnapping his niece," he said, more matter-of-factly.
Niece. I felt a small shiver run down my spine in spite of the warm weather. Niece to the Mackenzie chieftain. Not to mention to the war chieftain of Clan Mackenzie, riding so nonchalantly by my side. And on the other side, I was now presumably linked with Lord Lovett, chief of Clan Fraser, with the abbot of a powerful French abbey, and with who knew how many other assorted Frasers. No, perhaps Jonathan Randall wouldn't think it worthwhile to pursue me. And that, after all, had been the point of this ridiculous arrangement. I stole a glance at Jamie, riding ahead now. His back was straight as an alder sapling, and his hair shone under the sun like a helmet of burnished metal. Dougal followed my glance.
"Could have been worse, no?"
he said, with an ironic lift of his brow. 2 nights later, we were encamped on a stretch of moorland, near one of those strange outcroppings of glacier-pocked granite. It had been a long day's travel, with only a hasty meal eaten in the saddle, and everyone was pleased to stop for a cooked dinner. I had tried early on to assist with the cooking, but my help had been more or less politely rejected by the taciturn clansman whose job it apparently was. One of the men had killed a deer that morning, and a portion of the fresh meat, cooked with turnips, onions, and whatever else he could find, had made a delicious dinner. Bursting with food and contentment, we all sprawled around the fire, listening to stories and songs. Surprisingly enough, little Murta, who seldom opened his mouth to speak, had a beautiful, clear tenor voice. While it was difficult to persuade him to sing, the results were worth it. I nestled closer to Jamie, trying to find a comfortable spot to sit on the hard granite. We had camped at the edge of the rocky outcrop, where a broad shelf of reddish granite gave us a natural hearth, and the towering jumble of rocks behind made a place to hide the horses. When I asked why we didn't sleep more comfortably on the springy grass of the moor, Ned Gowan had informed me that we were now near the southern border of the Mackenzie lands, and thus near the territory of both Grants and Chisholms.
"Dougal's scouts say there's no sign of anyone nearabouts," he had said, standing on a large boulder to peer into the sunset himself. "But you can never tell. Better safe than sorry, you ken."
When Murta called it quits, Rupert began to tell stories. While he lacked Gwyllyn's elegant way with words, he had an inexhaustible fund of stories about fairies, ghosts, the Tanas, or evil spirits, and other inhabitants of the highlands, such as the water horses. These beings, I was given to understand, inhabited almost all bodies of water, being especially common at fords and crossings, though many lived in the depths of the lochs.
"There's a spot at the eastern end of Loch Garv, you ken," he said, rolling his eyes around the gathering to be sure everyone was listening, "that never freezes. It's always black water there, even when the rest of the loch is frozen solid, for that's the water horse's chimney."
The water horse of Loch Garv, like so many of his kind, had stolen a young girl who came to the loch to draw water, and carried her away to live in the depths of the loch and be his wife. Woe betide any maiden, or any man for that matter, who met a fine horse by the water's side and thought to ride upon him, for a rider, once mounted, couldn't dismount, and the horse would step into the water, turn into a fish, and swim to his home with the hapless rider still stuck fast to his back.
"Now, a water horse beneath the waves has but fish's teeth," said Rupert, wiggling his palm like an undulating fish, "and feeds on snails and water weeds and cold, wet things. His blood runs cold as the water, and he's no need of fire, do you ken? But a human woman's a wee bit warmer than that."
Here he winked at me and leered outrageously to the enjoyment of the listeners.
"So the water horse's wife was sad and cold and hungry in her new home beneath the waves, not caring overmuch for snails and waterweed for her supper. So the water horse, being a kindly sort, takes himself to the bank of the loch near the house of a man with the reputation of a builder. And when the man came down to the river and saw the fine golden horse with its silver bridle shining in the sun, he couldn't resist seizing the bridle and mounting. Sure enough, the water horse carries him straight into the water and down through the depths to his own cold, fishy home. And there, he tells the builder, if he would be free, he must build a fine hearth and a chimney as well, that the water horse's wife might have a fire to warm her hands and fry her fish."
I'd been resting my head on Jamie's shoulder, feeling pleasantly drowsy, and looking forward to bed, even if that was only a blanket spread over granite. Suddenly, I felt his body tense. He put a hand on my neck, warning me to keep still. I looked around the campsite and could see nothing amiss, but I caught the air of tension running from man to man, as though transmitted by wireless. Looking in Rupert's direction, I saw him nod fractionally as he caught Dougal's eye, though he went on with the story imperturbably.
"So the builder, having little choice, did as he was bid, and so the water horse kept his word and returned the man to the bank near his home. And the water horse's wife was warm then and happy and full of the fish she fried for her supper. And the water never freezes over the east end of Loch Garv, because the heat from the water horse's chimney melts the ice."
Rupert was seated on a rock, his right side toward me. As he spoke, he bent down as though casually to scratch his leg. Without the slightest hitch in his movements, he grasped the knife that lay on the ground near his foot and transferred it smoothly to his lap, where it lay hidden in the folds of his kilt. I wriggled closer and pulled Jamie's head down as though overcome by amorousness. "What is it?" I whispered in his ear. He seized my earlobe between his teeth and whispered back,
"The horses are restless. Someone's near."
One man got up and strolled to the edge of the rock to relieve himself. When he returned, he sat down in a new spot next to one of the drovers. Another man rose and peered into the cook pot, helping himself to a morsel of venison. All around the campsite there was a subtle shifting and moving, while Rupert kept on talking. Watching carefully, with Jamie's arm tight around me, I finally realized that the men were moving closer to wherever their weapons had been placed. All of them slept with their dirks, but generally left swords, pistols, and the round leather shields called the targe, in small, neat heaps near the edge of the campsite. Jamie's own pair of pistols lay on the ground with his sword just a few feet away. I could see the firelight dancing on the damascened blade. While his pistols were no more than the customary horn-handled dags worn by most of the men, both broadsword and claymore were something special. He had showed them to me with pride at one of our stops, turning the gleaming blades over lovingly in his hands. The claymore was wrapped inside his blanket roll. I could see the enormous T-shaped hilt, the grip roughened for battle by careful sanding. I had lifted it and nearly dropped it. It weighed close to 15 pounds, Jamie told me. If the claymore was sombre and lethal-looking, the broadsword was beautiful. Two-thirds the weight of the larger weapon, it was a deadly gleaming thing with Islamic tracery snaking its way up the blue steel blade to the spiral basket hilt, enamelled in reds and blues. I had seen Jamie use it in playful practice, first right-handed with one of the men-at-arms, later left-handed with Dougal. He was a glory to watch under those conditions, swift and sure, with a grace made the more impressive by his size. But my mouth grew dry at the thought of seeing that skill used in earnest. He bent toward me, planting a tender kiss under the edge of my jaw, and taking the opportunity to turn me slightly, so that I faced one of the jumbled piles of rocks. "Soon, I think," he murmured, kissing me industriously. "Do you see the small opening in the rock?"
I did. A space less than 3 feet high, formed by two large slabs fallen together. He clasped my face and nuzzled me lovingly.
"When I say go, get into it and stay there. Have you the dirk?"
He had insisted I keep the dirk he had tossed to me that night at the inn, despite my own insistence that I had neither the skill nor the inclination to use it. And when it came to insisting, Dougal had been right. Jamie was stubborn. Consequently, the dirk was in one of the deep pockets of my gown. After a day of uncomfortable awareness of its weight against my thigh, I had grown almost oblivious to it. He ran a hand playfully down my leg, checking to make certain of its presence. He lifted his head then, like a cat scenting the breeze. Looking up, I could see him glance at Murta, then down at me. The little man gave no outward sign, but rose and stretched himself thoroughly. When he sat down again, he was several feet nearer to me. A horse whickered nervously behind us. As though it had been a signal, they came screaming over the rocks. Not English, as I had feared, nor bandits. Highlanders shrieking like banshees. Grants, I supposed, or Campbells. On hands and knees, I made for the rocks. I banged my head and scraped my knees, but managed to wedge myself into the small crevice. Heart hammering, I fumbled for the dirk in my pocket, almost jabbing myself in the process. I had no idea what to do with a long, wicked knife, but felt slightly better for having it. There was a moonstone set in the hilt, and it was comforting to feel the small bulge against my palm. At least I knew I had hold of the right end in the darkness. The fighting was so confused that at first I had no idea what was going on. The small clearing was filled with yelling bodies, heaving to and fro, rolling on the ground and running back and forth. My sanctuary was luckily to one side of the main combat, so I was in no danger for the moment. Glancing around, I saw a small, crouching figure close by, pressed against my rock in the shadow. I took a firmer grip on my dirk, but realized almost at once that it was Murta. So that was the purpose of Jamie's glance. Murta had been told to guard me. I couldn't see Jamie himself anywhere. Most of the fighting was taking place in the rocks and shadows near the wagons. Of course, that must be the object of the raid, the wagons and the horses. The attackers were an organized band, well-armed and decently fed from the little I could see of them in the light of the dying fire. If these were Grants, then perhaps they were seeking either booty or revenge for the cattle Rupert and friends had pilfered a few days before. Confronted with the results of that impromptu raid, Dougal had been mildly annoyed, not with the fact of the raid, but only concerned that the cattle would slow our progress. He had managed to dispose of them almost at once, though, at a small market in one of the villages. It was soon clear that the attackers weren't much concerned with inflicting harm on our party, only with getting to the horses and wagons. One or two succeeded. I crouched low as a bare-backed horse leapt the fire and disappeared into the darkness of the moor, a caterwauling man clinging to its mane. Two or three more raced away on foot, clutching bags of Colum's grain, pursued by furious Mackenzie shouting Gaelic imprecations. From the sound of it, the raid was dying down. Then a large group of men staggered out into the firelight, and the action picked up again. This seemed to be serious fighting, an impression borne out by the flashing of blades and the fact that the participants were grunting a good deal, but not yelling. At length, I got it sorted out. Jamie and Dougal were at the centre of it, fighting back to back. Each of them held his broadsword in the left hand, dirk in the right, and both of them were putting the arms to good use, so far as I could see. They were surrounded by four men, or five, I lost count in the shadows, armed with short swords, though one man had a broadsword hung on his belt, and at least two more carried undrawn pistols. It must be Dougal, or Jamie, or both that they wanted. Alive, for preference. For ransom, I supposed. Thus, the deliberate use of small swords, which might merely wound rather than the more lethal broadsword or pistols. Dougal and Jamie suffered from no such scruples, and were attending to business with considerable grim efficiency. Back to back, they formed a complete circle of threat, each man covering the other's weaker side. When Dougal drove his dirk hand upward with considerable force, I thought that weaker might not be precisely the term. The whole roiling, grunting, cursing mess was staggering toward me. I pressed myself back as far as I could, but the crevice was barely 2 feet deep. I caught a stir of movement from the corner of my eye. Murta had decided to take a more active part in affairs. I could scarcely pull my horrified gaze away from Jamie, but saw the little clansman draw his pistol, so far unfired, in a leisurely manner. He checked the firing mechanism carefully, rubbed the weapon on his sleeve, braced it on his forearm, and waited. And waited. I was shivering with fear for Jamie, who had given up finesse and was slashing savagely from side to side, beating back the two men, who now faced him with sheer bloody-mindedness. "Why in hell didn't the man fire?" I thought furiously. And then I realized why not. Both Jamie and Dougal were in the line of fire. I seem to recall that flintlock pistols sometimes lacked a bit in the way of accuracy. This supposition was borne out in the next minute, as an unexpected lunge by one of Dougal's opponents caught him at the wrist. The blade ripped up the length of his forearm, and he sank to one knee. Feeling his uncle fall, Jamie pulled back his own blade and took two quick steps backward. This put his back near a rock face. Dougal crouched to one side, within reach of the protection of his single blade. It also brought the attackers side on to my hiding place and Murta's pistol. Close at hand, the report of the pistol was startlingly loud. It took the attackers by surprise, particularly the one who was hit. The man stood still for a moment, shook his head in a confused way, then, very slowly, sat down, fell limply backward, and rolled down a slight decline into the dying embers of the fire. Taking advantage of the surprise, Jamie knocked the sword from the hand of one attacker. Dougal was on his feet again, and Jamie moved to the side to give him room for sword play. One of the fighters had abandoned the fray and run down the hill to drag his wounded companion out of the hot ashes. Still, that left three of the raiders, and Dougal wounded. I could see dark drops splashing against the rock face as he wielded the sword. They were close enough now that I could see Jamie's face, calm and intent, absorbed with the exultancy of battle. Suddenly, Dougal shouted something to him. Jamie tore his eyes from his opponent's face for a split second and glanced down. Glancing back just in time to avoid being skewered, he ducked to one side and threw his sword. His opponent gazed in considerable surprise at the sword sticking in his leg. He touched the blade in some bemusement, then grasped it and pulled. From the ease with which it came out, I assumed the wound wasn't deep. The man still seemed slightly bewildered and glanced up as though to ask the purpose of this unorthodox behaviour. He uttered a scream, dropped the sword and ran, limping heavily. Startled by the noise, the other two attackers looked over, turned and likewise fled, pursued by Jamie, moving like an avalanche. He had succeeded in yanking the huge claymore out of the blanket roll and was swinging it in a murderous two-handed arc. Backing him up came Murtagh, shouting something highly uncomplimentary in Gaelic, and brandishing both sword and reloaded pistol. Things mopped up quite quickly after that, and it was only a quarter of an hour or so before the Mackenzie party had reassembled and assessed its damages. These had been slight. Two horses had been taken, and three bags of grain. But the drovers, who slept with their loads, had prevented further depredations on the wagons, while the men-at-arms had succeeded in driving off the would-be horse thieves. The major loss seemed to be one of the men. I thought, when he was missed at first, that he must have been wounded or killed in the scrimmage, but a thorough search of the area failed to turn him up.
"Kidnapped," said Dougal grimly. "Blast! He'll cost me a month's income in ransom." "Could have been worse, Dougal," said Jamie, mopping his face on his sleeve. "Think what Colin would say if they'd taken you. If they'd taken you, lad, I'd have let them keep you, and you could change your name to Grant," Dougal retorted.
But the mood of the party lightened substantially. I unearthed the small box of medical supplies I had packed and lined up the injured in order of severity. Nothing really bad, I was pleased to see. The wound on Dougal's arm was likely the worst. Ned Gowan was bright-eyed and fizzing with vitality, apparently so intoxicated with the thrill of the fight as hardly to notice the tooth that had been knocked out by an ill-aimed dagger hilt. He had, however, retained sufficient presence of mind to keep it carefully held under his tongue.
"Just on the off chance, d'ye see," he explained, spitting it into the palm of his hand.
The root wasn't broken, and the socket still bled slightly, so I took the chance and pressed the tooth firmly back into place. The little man went quite white, but didn't utter a sound. He gratefully swished his mouth with whisky for disinfectant purposes, though, and thriftily swallowed it. I had bound Dougal's wound at once with a pressure bandage, and was glad to see that the bleeding had all but stopped by the time I unwrapped it. It was a clean slash, but a deep one. A tiny rim of yellow fat showed at the edge of the gaping cut, which went at least an inch deep into the muscle. No major vessels severed, thank goodness, but it would have to be stitched. The only needle available turned out to be a sturdy thing like a slender awl, used by the drovers to mend harness. I eyed it dubiously, but Dougal merely held out his arm and looked away.
"I didn't mind blood in general," he explained, "but I've some objection to seeing my own."
He sat on a rock as I worked, teeth clenched hard enough to make his jaw muscles quiver. The night was turning cold, but sweat stood out on the high forehead in beads. At one point, he asked me politely to stop for a moment, turned aside, and was neatly sick behind a rock, then turned back and braced his arm on his knee again. By good luck, one tavern owner had chosen to remit his rent this quarter in the form of a small keg of whisky, and it came in quite handily. I used it to disinfect some of the open wounds, and then let my patients self-medicate as they liked. I even accepted a cupful myself at the conclusion of the doctoring. I drained it with pleasure, and sank thankfully onto my blanket. The moon was sinking, and I was shivering, half with reaction and half with cold. It was a wonderful feeling to have Jamie lie down and firmly gather me in, next to his large, warm body. "Will they come back, do you think?" I asked. But he shook his head.
"Nay, that was Malcolm Grant and his two boys. It was the oldest I stuck in the leg. They'll be home in their own beds by now," he replied.
He stroked my hair and said in softer tones,
"You did a braw bit of work tonight, lass. I was proud of you."
I rolled over and put my arms about his neck. Not as proud as I was. You were wonderful, Jamie. I've never seen anything like that. It's not